Hi, this is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, and you're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This episode has been edited for clarity and brevity. Happy listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's town meeting day. Some Vermont communities are having their floor meetings today, and many towns are holding votes by Australian ballot. Did you vote? Are you eligible to vote? Who gets to vote is as much a cultural and political idea as it is a right. Think back to the creation of the early United States. Laws around who can vote have changed significantly over time. Many early states, though not Vermont, restricted voting by wealth. You had to be a landowner to vote. For a long time, only men were allowed to vote. The 15th Amendment granted voting rights by statute, though not necessarily by practice, to African American men. But most Native Americans were actually not included in the way the amendment was written. At the time, most Native Americans were not considered full citizens. And the last state to codify suffrage for Native Americans didn't do so until 1962. We still have restrictions on voting by age, certainly by citizenship. But none of this is static, as we've seen throughout American history, and as we continue to see in the way voting restrictions and impediments are applied across the country. So today, as we mark the passing of yet another town meeting day in Vermont, we're going to look at who gets the right to vote and what's still in flux. Joining us is Bert Johnson, professor of political science at Middlebury College. He's been looking into how voting has changed over time and why voting laws are not the same throughout our history. Professor Johnson, it's nice to have you back.
Happy to be here, and I'm proud to say I voted.
Excellent work. And, you know, Middlebury is an interesting case if we're talking just about town meeting day. I don't know, actually, did you vote in Middlebury? Are you a Middlebury resident?
I actually have to confess that I do live in Burlington, so I voted in Burlington.
Why aren't you here then,
Bert? I attended Middlebury's town meeting last night.
Well, town meeting, we had Henry Epp did an interview with longtime town meeting moderator in his last year, Jim Douglas, of course, former governor of Vermont. And he was saying that one of the things that he sees in Middlebury's town meeting is that it's like closed circuit television. So people can watch from their homes, and he likes that that increases access to who gets to actually see what's happening in town meeting. But he feels like it's not a great thing because they're not necessarily coming actually to the floor meeting and participating in that way. So as we look at these questions of who's voting, who's participating, certainly that ability to attend something like a town meeting is actually a question about who gets to vote in this country and in Vermont and in municipal elections here. So how do you sort of overarchingly see our questions around how we determine who gets to vote? What is it about? It's not just a birthright citizenship kind of thing.
No, I think it's about who has stake in the community. And these arguments about voting qualifications go all the way back to the founding of the United States. It's who is sufficiently invested in what the community does and who the community is that we can give them a say in what the community does. So initially, that was people who owned property, and that was exactly the reasoning, that if you have property, that means you have a stake in the system. And although those qualifications have gone away over time, the arguments about having a stake in things is still present.
But isn't it the people in power who are determining how they say who has a stake in things? Because certainly people who live under the rules that are voted on by those who are quote unquote invested are also invested in their communities, whether or not they have the ability and the right to vote.
Well, that's right. And of course, the definition of what a stake in something really means has changed a lot. I recall a few years ago, there was a Middlebury College student who was running for state legislature, and people made the argument that this student really didn't have a sufficient stake in things because he wasn't a native of Middlebury and didn't have a house and some kids. So, you know, what your definition of having a stake in things is can really differ depending upon who we're talking about.
Let's talk about Vermont, and let's look back to our original constitution before we were even officially a state in the Union, because Vermont was a little bit different from some of the other colonies and some of the early voting rights in terms of, you know, who was allowed to. And you mentioned, Professor Johnson, that question of, you know, who owns land and who has the power in the community. What did Vermont say about who could vote?
Vermont has historically been quite permissive about who it allows to vote. In our 1777 Constitution, of course, we know from recent debates in the state legislature about its prohibition on slavery. But also in that constitution, it had no property qualification for voting, and that was unique among colonial constitutions at the time. So no property qualification at all. So other states might not have had a property qualification, but they had a qualification that you had to be a taxpayer. But Vermont did not have that, and that set a pattern historically that Vermont's qualifications for voting have been pretty broad relative to the rest of the country.
How did we determine who did have the right to vote in terms of who was a citizen? Because it wasn't, you know, obviously in those early days, who was a citizen of the United States? Was it just, I mean, if it wasn't by land, how did they determine who lived in the community?
Right. Usually there was – well, in some states there was a citizenship requirement that was encoded in state law. In Vermont, there was mostly just a residency requirement, especially for the first few decades of statehood. In 1828, they did put in a citizenship requirement for voting in state elections. But non-citizens could still vote in local elections at least until the 1860s in Vermont. And of course, nationally, citizenship at that time was ill-defined and continued to be disputed up through and after the Civil War.
So if there wasn't a restriction on being a landowner, having enough money to be able to vote in early Vermont, were there restrictions on age? Were people restricted by gender? Were de facto people restricted by race?
Well, of course, we're talking about men in Vermont at this time, and 21-year-old men. You had to take a voter's oath then as now and prove you were in good standing in the community. There was a provision you could be disenfranchised if you threatened – if you actually corruptly influenced the election. So if you bribed somebody to vote, you could be restricted. And of course, so all of these qualifications apply, and by our standards today, voting was extremely unequal at the time. Relative to other states, though, Vermont was doing pretty well. Now, I should say, of course, and Vermont had by 1855, Vermont was only one of five states that where there was no discrimination in the Constitution or the laws against African Americans voting. That might mean Vermonters were very virtuous, and I'd like to believe that. But it also might mean that there were very few African Americans in Vermont. The other states that had no discriminatory provisions were other New England states like Massachusetts and New Hampshire. We don't know exactly what happened in Vermont if and when an African American person attempted to vote. It could be that the action was not the letter of the law. Of course, when prejudices exist, that's sometimes the case.
Yeah, I mean, it's if there's not going to be a change in the balance of power, it doesn't cost that much to enfranchise more people. You know, if it's only a few people, if it doesn't actually affect your ability as, you know, a wealthy white man to continue to hold the power.
Right. And we see disputes about voting often occurring when elections are very close, when the divides between parties are very narrow, we start seeing disputes about voting crop up because even a difference of a percentage point or two could make the difference in who holds power.
We're talking today about who gets to vote. It often, I think, to many of us seems like, well, there are laws and those are the laws and they've always been the laws and that's just how it is. But as with many things in the United States and beyond, these things are fluid. They change over time. And a lot of how they change has to do with how we think about our society and what our cultural values are. And sometimes laws are one thing and practice is another. And there can be impediments to voting laws that aren't based on statute necessarily, but certainly in practice make it difficult for people to vote. Some people say, you know, one of the issues with town meeting is having a Tuesday during the day floor meeting for a state that doesn't declare this a state holiday is an impediment to voting for many younger people, for working people. Mark says whoever gets to cast their vote in the end, I think it should be done via Australian ballot. This system of voting will open up the opportunity to vote to more people who may be able to fit in a 15-minute visit to the polls on their way to or from work, but who may not be able to attend a dedicated town meeting. It's the 21st century, not the 19th century anymore. Requiring attendance at a dedicated town meeting in order for your vote to count is restrictive to the voting public, and it ignores the economic and social realities of 2019. Professor Johnson, what do you think about that question of, you know, the ways that we actually create the ability to vote or make it accessible to people does also change the balance of who gets to vote and who has that power.
That's absolutely right. And if you can't take time off for an hours-long town meeting, either last night or today, you may be effectively disenfranchised. But of course, you know, it's important to keep in mind what you said at the beginning about Governor Douglas's comment, that there is something about actually being present that creates a qualitatively different kind of participation. It's really different when you have to sit there in a meeting and hear people break down the cost of a new plow blade versus having it on television and being able to do other things. You really have to start paying attention to that plow blade, like it or not, and it's a qualitatively different kind of participation.
It's interesting, too, in Vermont, there are lots of different ways that different communities are trying to address that issue. You know, does Burlington even have a floor meeting? It's sort of an informational meeting, but no voting, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's all Australian ballot.
Yeah, so it's all Australian ballot in Burlington. My town of Moncton switched to a Saturday meeting a couple years ago. And, you know, in some cases, Saturday meetings aren't actually increasing participation in the meeting. I don't mean to say that for Moncton in particular, but some communities have gone back to a Tuesday meeting. Some communities have a Monday meeting. Many communities vote some things from the floor and others by Australian ballot. And some communities do it all from the floor or almost all from the floor. So it sounds like, Professor Johnson, there are ways that communities are trying to figure out that balance of how can we get the most people to participate because we want them to be involved in communal and community affairs.
That's right. Yes. And it is a balance. And it's each community is deciding that for itself. You know, having a night meeting might allow certain people to have an easier time coming, but might disenfranchise other people who have to work a different shift. So it is a balance.
Or, you know, my example was I solo parent most weekends and I couldn't take a 2- and a 5-year-old to town meeting on a Saturday, whereas they'd actually be in childcare on a Tuesday, although I certainly wouldn't be able to go on a Tuesday either. But, you know, there are many questions that go into how do you try to get the most people available or able to be at a town meeting. Let's go to Patrick, who's calling in from Westford. Hi, Patrick. What are you thinking about when we talk about who gets to vote?
Hi. So for many years before I moved to Vermont, I lived in Tacoma Park, Maryland, where non-citizens were able to, including undocumented citizens, were able to vote. And I think that I believe in Tacoma Park, that was passed in 1992. And far from being some sort of radical idea, you know, seeing it first place, it seems to have worked out fine. Now, this is, of course, just for municipal elections. Non-citizen residents could not vote for, say, president or senator. But as long as you could show, you know, say, with a piece of, you know, mail that you live within the bounds of Tacoma Park, you could vote there. And my second point is just real quick, you know, at a time in our history when it seems like both here and across the globe that democracy is on the retreat, I think, you know, those of us who want to see this reinvigorated may want to look to, you know, what does it look like to expand the scope of democracy in our society, you know, in general. Most of us spend our, you know, a good portion of our waking lives, you know, not within a democracy, but within the workplace, which is anything but democratic. So I think, you know, if we can try and recapture, I think, a lot of the democratic spirit that we still have in Vermont and apply it elsewhere, I think we could strike a blow not just for democracy, but for greater citizen participation and accountability in government.
Yeah, Patrick, I appreciate your thoughts and your reflections. And just to ask you about your experience in Tacoma Park in Maryland, are you a U.S. citizen? Do you mind if I ask? So this wasn't something that affected you, but you supported this ability for non-U.S. citizens to vote in Tacoma Park affairs?
That's right. Yeah. So I'm a natural born citizen, but my neighbor, you know, right next to me in my apartment building, was a refugee from Sudan and was, you know, I'm ashamed to admit, much more active in civic affairs of the town than I was. So it would have been very silly if they couldn't have a vote, but I could.
Well, thank you for sharing your perspective. I appreciate that. And we're actually going to talk about an initiative in Vermont that's continuing to move through the system that would address that. But before we do, Bert Johnson, can you remind us of when and how non-U.S. citizens have been able to vote and in which elections?
Well, non-U.S. citizens have been able to vote in various elections over time. Probably it was more common in the early part of the 19th century when states were doing it differently. And as I said before, in Vermont, non-citizens could vote, at least for the first few decades in that century, in any Vermont election. More recently, states have put in restrictions on that. But I think the other thing that Patrick says that I think is interesting to point out is that in many cases, the locality can have a different standard for who votes than the state and certainly than the national government as a whole. And that's a common pattern over time, that municipalities have done things differently from their states and from the whole government. So it's certainly possible that municipalities can decide to have some different rules depending upon what they think is appropriate.
We got a note from Lynn who says, I came to Vermont 30 years ago from England, first on a visa, then a green card, and several years ago I became a citizen. I support the right of legal residents to be able to vote. It troubled me that as a visa holder and a green card holder, I could work and I was obliged to pay taxes but did not have the right to vote. Wasn't there a little war some time ago about that, something about taxation without representation? And while we're on the subject of non-U.S. citizens and who among them is allowed to vote and in what, let's look at what's happening right now in Montpelier. Ann Watson is the mayor of the city of Montpelier. Before becoming mayor last year, she served for more than 5 years on the city council, and she's also a teacher at Montpelier High School. Mayor Watson, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So in Montpelier, there is this question about whether the community will allow and should allow non-U.S. citizen residents to be able to vote in municipal affairs. So where does that currently stand?
So last November, we had that as a question on the ballot. So in order for legal residents who are not U.S. citizens to be able to participate in those municipal level elections, we had to change our charter. I mean, that's something that has to be approved by the council and a vote of the public, and then it ultimately has to be approved by the legislature. So last November, we had that as a question on the ballot. So, you know, should we allow legal residents, non-citizens to participate in this way, to vote in municipal elections. And it was approved. And so that went to the legislature. And I was just actually last week testifying on this this item in the GovOps committee. And so they'll be hopefully taking a vote on it pretty soon.
And so the legislature has to grant you this ability to change your charter, but you feel confident that Montpelier residents want to be able to have more of the actual citizens of the community, even if they're not American citizens, to be able to participate in community affairs?
Yeah. So that measure passed by 66%. So pretty popular. And I think the voice of Montpelier is pretty clear that we want to be able to include our legal resident non-citizen neighbors, friends, and spouses in our democracy.
And you support that idea too?
I do, yeah.
So what about the argument that one of the primary reasons to become a U.S. citizen is to get this right to vote in the country that you are a citizen of? You've proven that, you know, you want to be part of this system. You believe in this system. You've educated yourself about the system. And until and unless you become a citizen, that is a right that is excluded because that is one of the rights that comes with citizenship. Are we sort of diluting the need to become a citizen or the benefits of being a citizen if we allow people to vote when they're not U.S. citizens?
You know, I hear that concern. It makes me consider that, you know, there are still restrictions on how that non-citizen could vote. You know, they would not be able to participate in state or federal elections. And in fact, any issue that is beyond just the scope of Montpelier would actually not be something that they would be able to vote on. So, for example, Montpelier recently had a school merger situation, and so we would be removing any school-related items from the ballot that a non-citizen would be voting on. It's a pretty limited scope of what we are extending in terms of voting rights to legal resident non-citizens. But this is a way for us to be welcoming to those neighbors. I mean, they live in our community. Their children go to our schools and they're paying taxes and, you know, they really are, members of our community. So, you know, this feels like a pretty straightforward, simple way for us to enfranchise them, to be welcoming to them.
And if this is approved by the legislature and Montpelier is allowed to make a change to the city charter, when would non-citizen residents be able to vote?
So anything beyond July potentially would have that as an option. But really, we are going to need to take a little time in Montpelier to figure out our processes to build some of the logistics. And so, excuse me. So we anticipate that, it might be ready for the following November or of 2019, this November, or at least, by next town meeting day.
All right. So town meeting day 2020, we'll see what happens in Montpelier. Ann Watson is the mayor of the city of Montpelier. Thank you very much for talking with us here on town meeting day. I appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Justin emailed in to say limited access to voting also relates to employment. I'm a school teacher who works an 8-hour day. My school is open today. I can't go vote. And let's go to Andrea calling in from Hinesburg. Hi, Andrea. What are your thoughts?
Hi. I have a couple of comments. And not only pertain to who votes, but I campaigned for the first time 27 years ago for run for select board, and was just astonished at how many people who were renting felt that they didn't have the right to vote. And I was just, at the time, I was also registering people to vote, so I was really glad to be able to explain to people that even though in town we're mostly voting on budget that has to do with property taxes, that their landlord was, considering that basically they did have a right to vote was my opportunity to educate people that even renters, or especially renters, can vote. And the other thing was that at town meeting, we also are voting on, we're voting on a budget, and having prepared budgets for the last 27 years on the select board, oftentimes I reflect on, do people understand that the budget is reflecting what our community values are? And we might be voting on a road budget, but do people understand that when we're doing that, we're really making a statement about the environment? How are we taking care of our roads? Are we doing proper ditching? And I'm always wanting to help voters and taxpayers understand that a budget is a reflection of our values.
Well, Andrea, I appreciate what you're saying, because that idea of civic engagement, and I really find it interesting, too, that in your experience, people who were renting didn't feel as enfranchised or didn't feel like they had as much of a right, perhaps, to be making choices about things like budgets. Because, we go back to early colonial history and this question of landowners being the ones who had the right or had the power to vote. And so it's interesting to see that sort of reflection continuing to come through in American politics here in municipal affairs in Vermont. Let's go to Steve in Springfield. Hey, Steve.
To go along with that, I guess my question is very closely tied in. If you own land in one town, but you're a resident in another town, you're required to pay property tax in the town you own land, but you are not a resident, so therefore you can't vote. So you're taxed without representation again. And I guess that's the logic kind of behind, especially since most of the revenue for town government, schools and so forth is raised through the property tax.
So, Steve, is this something that you, you personally experienced? Do you think that landowners who are non-resident should be able to vote in the towns that they own land in?
Not necessarily, but I just brought it up as a quandary. We're talking about trying to be fair and giving people the right to vote. I'm thinking that even somebody from Connecticut that owns land here, they're paying the property tax here, but they're resident of Connecticut, so they can't help determine what their property taxes are going to be because they can't vote.
Yeah, Steve, it's a really interesting question. Bert Johnson, what about that? Because, we've talked about getting away from this idea that only people who had enough money to own land should be the ones to vote. But then there are people who say, but land ownership means you're getting taxed. You are subject to the rules of the municipality in which you own land. And yet it's more nuanced than that. We're talking about who lives where and who's a citizen, and that question of who's invested and by what measure is a really interesting one.
That is an interesting question, and I'm not sure I have an answer for someone who lives in Connecticut and owns land in Vermont. But if you own land in a different town from where you live, I think the virtue of having a system of state and local government is that what you can do is you can talk to your state representatives and ask them to change the rules surrounding localities if you feel as if you're being mistreated by the locality. So there is some ways in which you can exert your voice in that kind of setting.
We've been talking a little bit about how voting laws change over time, and that is certainly the case right now in New Hampshire. It's, of course, a big political battleground. And right now, there are about 60 tweaks that are being considered in one way or another, whether it's a lawsuit, a proposal, a challenge to a law. So joining us now to give us a little bit of context and some examples is Casey McDermott, who covers policy and politics for New Hampshire Public Radio. Casey, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Thanks so much.
So I said almost 60 different challenges or tweaks of some sort. Can you characterize them? Are they all of a piece or are they 60 different kinds of things?
There are lots of different things that are on the table. So I spent some time in the last few weeks just trying to wrap my head around this and came up with a few different categories or buckets that these proposed legislative changes fall under. And, you know, I think the one that is attracting the most attention or the most significant debate gets back to the conversation that you guys have been having this hour. It's who can vote in New Hampshire. So that comes down to where the state draws a line on residency or what steps someone would have to take to prove residency, as well as there's even a proposal on the table that does have some measure of bipartisan support that would allow 17-year-olds to vote in primary elections if they're old enough to participate in that year's general election. So that's one category. There's also how voters can register, how voters cast their ballots. So, for example, looking at the ranked choice approach that has been adopted in Maine and that's under consideration in other states nationwide. And then from a more big picture standpoint, there's questions of who can run, who can get on the ballot, how campaigns are run, what kind of oversight there is around campaigns and campaign finance, and also how candidates can spend their campaign money. So there's a bill on the table right now that actually would allow New Hampshire candidates to spend campaign money on childcare. And I think that's in part a reflection of we're starting to see more young parents get involved in politics in New Hampshire. And that's one issue that I think has come up in the course of their campaigns.
Yeah, I mean, money and how it's spent and who gets to have it. And certainly that question of childcare for people who are campaigning is an interesting one because of that again, that question of access. And it's in this case, access to being a candidate. But, you know, if you can't afford to run or you can't use campaign funds to care for your small children while you run, that can be disenfranchising. So that's really interesting, too. You mentioned ranked choice, and Jim in Rutland really likes the idea of ranked choice and wants it here in Vermont, says, I'd like something like ranked voting, especially in the primary or other first round votes. I want to vote for who I think will be the right president or other candidate without the risk of getting the exact opposite of what I want. Casey, one of the things that always seems to come up is this question around college students, and particularly in New Hampshire, it always seems to be this perennial issue and often seems focused on Dartmouth and the Hanover area and whether or not college students who are, you know, can sort of declare residency in New Hampshire or in their home state, how and when they should be allowed to vote. Is that an issue right now?
Oh, totally. And it has been for quite some time. It's heated up a lot in the last few years. But in doing some research on the issue, you know, I've discovered that it's actually been a debate that's been going on for decades in New Hampshire. And there's actually, as of the last month or so, there are two separate federal lawsuits that are challenging a recent change in the law that would you know, that some people would argue would limit the ability of college students to vote in New Hampshire when they're living in New Hampshire. And that those lawsuits draw upon a ruling from the 1970s that actually involved an out-of-state student at Dartmouth. So to your point, you know, Dartmouth has very much been at the center of this issue going back decades, but it's also come up with regard to other schools across New Hampshire. And, you know, the big issue here is this issue of domicile. So New Hampshire does not necessarily have a residency requirement in the sense that someone has to live in the state for 10 days, 30 days, 60 days in order to vote here. But the law has been changed recently to adjust how people prove that they are domiciled in New Hampshire. And domicile itself is, of course, a kind of, you know, distinct concept. It's a lot of people describe it as it's a state of mind. It's the place that you're calling home at that particular point in time. So that's, of course, raised a lot of questions from people who, you know, might believe that for example, out-of-state college students should not be able to say that, well, this is my home at this point, but I might not be here forever. So there's a big debate right now in terms of how you draw the line, where you draw the line, what steps students or even other people beyond students would have to take to prove that they actually live where they're trying to vote.
Casey, you've been looking at all of these pieces of legislation and lawsuits and proposals and thinking about them. And then also, you know, listening to this conversation about how we determine who gets to vote. And I'm wondering how you reflect on what's happening in New Hampshire and how that speaks to the ways our voting laws and our culture changes over time.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because I think I've had to kind of do a little bit of a gut check in my own reporting in that a lot of the debate at the State House revolves around students and the impact that this might have on college students. And that's because I think that both parties would agree, Democrats and Republicans, that the college campuses and the college towns in New Hampshire do hold significant sway. And if there is a close election, sometimes they can make the difference in kind of putting it over the finish line for one party or the other. That being said, I think that it's really important for people to keep in mind, and particularly in New Hampshire, that these are not just issues that are faced by college students. This is also something that may be, you know, may present challenges or may present hurdles to people who have issues with housing insecurity, to even people who just move around a lot by virtue of the kind of work that they do or, you know, needing to be caregivers or spend time with family members in or out of state. So I think it's worth, you know, kind of taking a step back and realizing that this is a kind of, you know, an issue that comes up for a lot of people as our society becomes more mobile, more generally speaking.
Casey McDermott is a reporter covering policy and politics for New Hampshire Public Radio. Casey, I really appreciate your insight and your knowledge of all of these many, many, many different changes that are potentially happening to New Hampshire voting laws. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Bert Johnson, before we let you go, what do you think about all of this when you think about enfranchisement and suffrage and who gets to vote? And Casey in particular saying, you know, our society is changing. We are more mobile. People are moving around a lot. And that changes our culture, too. And does that at some point get reflected in voting laws?
Well, what Casey was saying reminds me of what our caller Andrea said earlier about renters. I have had conversations with college students where they are worried that they shouldn't vote because they don't have a stake in the community. And what I would say to that is, first of all, we want to form as good habits early in life. And research has shown that your engagement with electoral politics when you're young can set a pattern for the rest of your life. And that's really important. But the second thing, and I think this takes us to the broader conversation, is you vote not just for you, but so that the community as a whole can gain the benefit of your perspective. Nobody else has had the experiences that you've had and can bring them to bear on the political system in the way that you can. So you're doing it because you want to contribute to the community, not just because you want some selfish benefit. And I think that's really important to remember here.
Well, interesting to think about, and particularly as we're, some of us anyway, are focused on what's happening around our communities here on Town Meeting Day. Bert Johnson is a professor of political science at Middlebury College. Bert, thanks very much to you, and thanks to the college for providing a studio for you.
You're very welcome.